he's saying this. Green let the remark pass, but it didn't occur to him that Eisner might think the same about him. But then, just before Thanksgiving, Eisner summoned Green to his office. Paul Pressler, the young, energetic executive who had succeeded Steve Burke at running the Disney stores, had just gotten a job offer from toy company Mattel. Pressler was handsome, charismatic, a personal favorite of Eisner. "Nothing personal. I don't want to hurt you, but I'm promoting Paul to president of Parks and Resorts," Eisner informed Green. "You can stay as long as you want, but you won't have any responsibilities." Green was stunned. He'd had no warning. He had delivered the results Eisner and the financial planners had asked for. Eisner had even praised him in his autobiography for the special passion he'd brought to building the animal kingdom, and for his creativity as a jazz pianist. Although Pressler was well-liked within the company and had brought some creative ideas to the Disney stores, his division had been faltering from a dearth of new products. Green agreed to remain in the largely titular position of chairman of Parks and Resorts until he had completed negotiations for a new theme park in Hong Kong. Then his long Disney career would be over. With his departure, the only executive left from the pre-Eisner era would be Dick Cook. Much as Joe Roth enjoyed his position at Disney and at times had enjoyed working with Eisner, Eisner was making his life increasingly miserable. Eisner confronted him with increasingly contradictory and therefore impossible demands to slash production, reduce costs, and yet maintain market share and continue to be the number one or two studio at the box office. There was constant tension between Eisner's belief in a low-budget, single and doubles approach and the new pressures of costly tentpole or event movies with big stars and special effects. Roth concluded it made sense to stay only if he had a reasonable chance of moving up to president or succeeding Eisner as chief executive. Given Eisner's reaction to his earlier suggestion that he be named president, both possibilities seemed remote. Roth's contract would expire on January 1, 2000, so toward the end of 1998, with little more than a year remaining, he gave Eisner notice that he planned to leave the company when his contract expired. Eisner invited him to lunch and said he didn't believe him. "I'm not really unhappy," Roth said, "but you don't want me to do what I want to do. You don't want to make me president." This was true. Eisner was increasingly leaning toward Bob Iger and had already broached the possibility to him. But Eisner didn't say anything. A few months later, Roth reminded Eisner of his decision to leave. "I haven't changed my mind," he said. "You won't really leave," Eisner said again. "Why not?" "No one will answer your phone calls," Eisner said. "Michael," Roth answered. "That's called projection." Eisner thought for a moment. "Maybe that's true, but you'll see." The dispute between Jeffrey Katzenberg and Michael Eisner over Katzenberg's bonus finally went to trial on April 16, 1999. "I've been waiting 5 years for this," Katzenberg told the press, his wife Marilyn at his side as they gathered in a makeshift courtroom at his lawyer's offices in Century City. Serving as an arbitrator in the case was distinguished former judge Paul Breckinridge. In the intervening years, Disney had conceded that it owed Katzenberg